welcome everybody to the Berkman Tuesday Lunch Series. I'm John Palfrey. Welcome you here to the Berkman Center. It's a great crowd we have today and a fun celebratory topic. We're kicking off this fall a series of events to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Berkman Center. We are 10 years old this academic year, hard to imagine. And so in the spirit of being 10 years old, we want to do both some reflection on what we as a broad community have learned over the last 10 years, but also look to the next decade of work in this area. And today's session is jointly a celebration of one web day, the brainchild of Professor Susan Crawford, teaches at Cardozo, and many others in the community, as well as a chance to start this process of both reflection and looking ahead. So, for Berkman fellows slash faculty, we'll introduce this topic of the future of the internet. Jonathan has a book coming out on this. He will. That's why he gets to go last. Jean, then, or Wendy, then Jean, then Judith will go first. So maybe Wendy Seltzer, I would suggest you come closer to the team here, if you would. You guys start us off.
All right, thank you. Thanks very much, and I'm going to start by being a bit disruptive to the subject here because David and John asked me to speak about the future of the internet, and I demurred because I'm not a very good futurist, and plus I think that the present of the internet is much more exciting than any particular future that I could predict.
Plus, as a professor, you know about quarreling with the hypothetical
and start out. because I think at the present we could say we're at the point of a light cone of lots of possible futures of what could happen with the internet. And if we're forced to choose one of those futures, we set ourselves down a course in that direction that closes off lots of other exciting possibilities in those other possible directions. And I don't want to have to choose between a peer-to-peer marketplace where individuals can offer up the things that they've discovered in their attic or the things that they've built, and a commercial marketplace where a big commercial polished emporium offering the goods online that they had previously offered offline. The eBay or the BarnesandNoble.com choice. I don't want to choose between professionally produced music and offered in professionally packaged downloads and the individual singer-songwriters who go and find collaborators online and independent production companies that spring up to offer their wares there. I don't want to choose between journalism as produced by the New York Times and journalism as produced by those the Times might have referred to as its dear readers just a few years ago. And if 10 years ago we had been asked to make this same sort of prediction about what the net would look like now, would we have predicted that typing a query into a bar in our web browsers would bring up nearly always a good answer to that query, and then that good answer would be produced not by the top-down coordination of a World Book or a Encarta or a Britannica, but by hundreds of thousands of individuals typing in their own self-interest into web logs and web bulletin boards and answer forums and even sometimes going and editing an online encyclopedia to reflect their interests and subjects of expertise. Would we have predicted the takeoff of social networking sites, the current darling Facebook developed out of a dorm room here? Would we have predicted the sharing of photos and travel and likes and hates and loves based on what we individually wanted to share with friends and not necessarily based on what marketers wanted us to help to elaborate their product offerings? Would we have predicted that the biggest and currently most successful video sharing site would have been developed not by the current leader in portals or in text search, which was trying very hard, of course, Google, to develop its own video, but by a few unknowns working jointly with the new tools that were out there available to all of us to develop something that eventually Google bought because it couldn't produce in-house something that was equally good. And if we were trying to regulate based on our years ago predictions, would we have left the network open to these user-driven innovations? I'm afraid we wouldn't have, and I want to warn us against that kind of, single future thinking regulation today. Because the beauty of the network to date has been that it's allowed the unplanned development. Because the tools are cheap, college kids in their dorm rooms can build products and services that compete with the college dropouts formed companies of a decade or generation earlier, because the connectivity is cheap. They can network in collaborators and collaborate and co-develop with the users of their software and services, because they don't need permission from any central regulator. They can launch sites that compete with established business models. They don't need to have a business model that they can present to a regulator before they launch their sites and tools. I'm sure Jonathan will talk about the spammers and scammers and other problems that this unregulated network allows to proliferate, but the network and the offline world have also been helping us to develop the tools to fight those, and I think there too, rather than try to predict all of the evils, we should plan for the openness that allows us to self-generate the tools to help ourselves to fight them. As I said, I'm not trying to predict any particular future, but to make us think of all of the possibilities that are just germinating now, and to continue to regulate this space with the light touch that will allow today's users to become tomorrow's innovators and co-developers of the NAT.
Quite wonderful, thank you.
Thank you.
Doing commentators, and then go to discussion after that. One just rhetorical question. I wonder if 10 years ago you would have said, roughly speaking, the same thing when you were here as one of the first students of the Berkman Center. I think the answer is you might, but you can come back to that, which is we should leave open opportunities, and that's a strong normative statement, effectively, about what the future ought to be, if not prediction.
Yes, well, I think that was one of the first things I learned coming into the Berkman Center 10 years ago, and seeing openness in so many different places throughout the mission.
Right, Charlie, wherever you are, that's your tune. Gene Koo, Berkman Fellow, someone working on a slightly different set of topics. Unfortunately, I saw him nodding a lot while we were talking. I'm hoping that we'll have some dynamic creative tension here. Maybe when Judith Donat comes up next, we'll get some more creative dynamic tension. But Gene Koo.
I think the internet will become increasingly important in supporting and sustaining our civic communities. And I believe that 3D virtual worlds are illustrating how technology will help make that happen, and online games in particular within those worlds suggest a shape of what a future civic life might look like. And I came to the internet later than a lot of the people who are affiliated with the Berkman Center during the heyday of web-based forums about 1999, 2000. And there I found rich communities and I made deep friendships. And a lot of my non-virtual friends found those relationships puzzling, maybe even troubling. And today we see that same dichotomy between acceptance and rejection of 3D worlds as real or not real. But the trend, I think, is towards assimilating a larger and larger percentage of the population with each technological breakthrough, whether it's 3D virtualization, whether it's in Second Life or Half-Life, or kinetic motion like the Nintendo Wii, or something that hasn't even been thought up yet, except maybe at the Media Labs down the street from us. And traditionalists worry that this kind of assimilation will destroy our existing civic life. And on the flip side, net utopians actually look forward to that destruction. But I think Yochai Benkler is right to find the middle ground between the two positions, that virtual networks often extend rather than replace our physical networks. My colleague Eric Gordon at Emerson calls this embrace net locality. And it's what you do every time you pick up your cell phone and you ask, where are you? Because we're still grounded in the physical reality, even as we're also projecting into the virtual one. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the computer game industry is advancing many of the technologies and the techniques that are making all this happen. Games are about engagement, and it turns out that what engages human beings most is really other people. And game developers are figuring out how to get people to form teams and achieve goals together. And corporate managers are taking notes. And those of us who care about civic and political engagement should take notes too. Robert Putnam worried about people who are bowling alone. Anyone who's seen World of Warcraft would stop worrying about whether the internet can build social capital. I think it can. And instead wonder, how is it going to help us to spend that capital? And I see two future worlds. In one, we have the Matrix. Virtual worlds become the new opiate of the disempowered masses. And we emigrate, as Ted Casanova puts it, and never look back. And in the other, we have what Beth Novick calls democracy the video game. Our institutions of work and governance learn from and adapt the technologies of play. And in that vision of the future, virtual worlds allow us to enhance and make more meaningful our relationships to our employers, to our governments, and most of all, to each other.
You referenced, Jean, the MIT Media Lab. Judith Donat, here is the MIT Media Lab. Judith, my secret desire is that at the end of the year you will not refer to yourself as Professor Media Lab or Berkman Fellow second, but rather the other way around. Or be Berkman Fellow and later.
Those are the significance of the final point. But so I know you're hoping we would all disagree, but I'll start by saying that what I also wanted to talk about is how much what people really want to see is other people. And what I was thinking about when I was asked to talk about this is what happens with search when search really becomes about people. You know, we're starting to see the beginnings now of intelligent searches where your results look different when what you're searching for is an address. You get a map. If you're searching for something to buy, you get a list of stores. So there's beginning to be some intelligence that said, looking at the type of thing you're searching for changes the form we put the results in. And I started thinking, a lot of what people are looking for, if you look at, Google's list of the top named things, it's all names. It's names of people in the news. It's somebody's friend. It's all kinds of things like that. So what does search end up like when Google or some other company says, okay, we're going to think about how to specialize your results for a person? And let's think about this in a couple of different contexts, because one, part of it is right now, as Wendy said, 10 years ago, would you have really expected all the useful information that's up there? And I'd like you to think about what are the things that we don't expect to find out about someone when we put their name into Google now, but in 10 years it might be possible, because 10 years ago, there were no social networking sites. People weren't writing every single thing they did at a party last night. They're not discussing the details of their miscarriage on a blog, but that stuff is all out there right now. And so when you start to think about in 10 years, we'll have a couple of generations of people who've grown up with the idea that, one, you can put everything into places that you think of maybe as private. Some of them are clearly public, and they just hadn't really thought about them as public. And some are places that maybe they're private today. But what happens when everyone moves on from Facebook and it goes out of business? Is part of the fire sale all that information? Maybe like a company that will put it all up will be the ones that will help them bail out their creditors. Who knows? So a lot of this information is going to be increasingly out there. You walked into this room today and you were told, okay, this is being webcast. Everything you say is online. It's all part of your permanent record. Now, but think how fascinating it's... Yeah, exactly. So here's your name. It's all very clear who you are and that you were in this room on this day, on this place, and you're nodding to this or you're disagreeing with something else. And so when a search engine comes up that can take all these little bits of information, the fact that your name is linked to how much you paid for your house, and we could come up with this portrait, I mean, it's going to be an amazing place. It really is going to be much more so than perhaps today's 3D graphical world, a real second life where the types of things you might be able to feel and see about other people by seeing them walk down the street is going to seem kind of a pale, shadow of the richness of what you can get to know about someone by Googling their name. But some of the things we need to think about, perhaps on the positive side, is, you know, in some good ways, is how to make this happen. It's a fascinating world where what will come up is this amazing data portrait, perhaps with some temporal elements. You can see the patterns and what people have said. You could get to all their conversations. You can know, you know, all the things they said, their level of activities. You could see, because of all the social networks they've been in, you can get links to all their friends. You can see them in this extraordinarily rich context. But that also gives us another perspective for thinking about how we want to see privacy, how we want to make people think about where their information is going. When we think about what I think is the inevitability of this kind of beautiful, rich data portrait, how do we want to, whether it's regulation of privacy, how we want to think about the use of names, the use of anonymity, what are the things you really sign away when you join a website, what are the things we want to think about, whether they're technological or social solutions for expiring information about people, for even better understanding of what information is significant, what's true, what are the things that this person has agreed are valid, what are the things that they dispute. Is there a personal Wikipedia where you can have a discussion page of all the things that have ever been said about you? So that was my reaction to thinking about the future of the web, is the question about what is the future of what will people look like on the web. So thank you.
Not quite a dystopian, but getting closer. this month anyway, which is good. So Jonathan, are you there?
I am here.
All right, so here are your marching orders. In 5 minutes, you have to accomplish three things. One is to talk about the book that you've spent several years writing. Let's crystallize that. Secondly, tie together the disparate threads of three people you've just heard. And third, be sure to disagree and create some dynamic tension out of which conversation will flow in this room.
Okay, then. Ready to go. I come from cyberspace, the new home of mine. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. Oh, I'm sorry, that's John Perry Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, which, while written 10 years ago, seems to fit the bill pretty well. My sense is that we live in a time of fashion and fear. Fashion is the wonderful set of ads for the iPod of those silhouettes, completely faceless people dancing around, but looking so much cooler than you sitting on the couch, not dancing around, watching them on your television. Fashion is an expression of your identity, but as we understand fashion today, it's kind of a superficial expression. It's like, do you want a blue iPod or a red iPod? Thank you very much. I did it in your honor, John. And in that sense, fashion is kind of giving your proxy away to some other entity that's going to help you decide what's cool and what's not. That's the prevailing mode of fashion right now. We gather in Milan or New York, or we read the newspaper that tells us about the gatherings there as to what's cool and what's not and what we should rush out and buy. The other element that seems to be running around today is fear. We live in a time where we're scared that at any moment really bad people with whom we have nothing in common and only want to hurt us and who hate us for our freedoms are perhaps garnering the tools to actually hurt us and make our lives very difficult. And I think that fear also tends to have us give our proxies away to ask people with expertise, with power in a position different from ours, to take responsibility for making us safe. And I'm concerned that these two phenomena of fashion and fear can be leading to trouble. When Tim Berners-Lee was designing the net, he said at one point, the web that is, he was thinking of building into HTTP protocol a way of saying if you couldn't get to a server, because back in 1993 or 94, servers weren't that reliably accessible, you could ask nearby computers on your net, by the way, has anybody recently visited this server? And if so, do you have the page I'm trying to get? That was almost built into just background HTTP. And then he never got around to it. And it turned out not to be all that necessary because servers were very accessible. It's funny now that as servers become inaccessible due to filtering and other blockages, it would have been nice to have had that feature all along. And it kind of emphasizes just how much our network architecture actually affects how much a response to fear could change the internet that we have. And I'm a little bit sad that the internet that apocryphally is said to be nuclear war resistant, and that was one of its motives, although why anybody would want to check email after a nuclear war is not clear to me, is in fact not. That the kinds of technologies like peer-to-peer have ended up being used for purposes in the public eye and demonized such that they're not developing so quickly, and Web 2.0 is very much of the let's pick a server and access it model. And that means that should there come a moment when somebody wants to shut down the party that the previous colleagues are so excited about, it actually, to me, would not be that hard a thing to do. They've said famously that society is 9 meals away from total collapse. Anybody that hasn't eaten for 3 days is ready to pretty much do anything to get a happy meal. And I wonder how many downed servers we are away from actually depriving ourselves of the net as we know it. From genes, peons, to online games and such, that's just one server. The entire World of Warcraft is yankable with one plug. Calls to mind the South Park episode on the subject in which the grave executives at Blizzard Software look at each other and say, this could be the end of the World of Warcraft as we know it. Wendy's talk appeared to be, if I may summarize in 5 seconds, the enemy is big media, but we don't have to kill it. We just have to compete with it on a level playing field. But even there, that boils down to elements of net architecture, because Wendy's chosen means of competing is to have teenagers in dorm rooms cooking up new stuff that's really compelling to each other and eventually to us. And our net architecture that allows that right now, I worry, is falling victim to fashion, appliancization, and fear, the kinds of lockdown we would see if the internet is used as an instrument of disruption by people who are really out to get us. Finally, Judith told us about the link between fashion and fear, that as we blog about everything and do it as expressions of our identity, the way that fashion is, we could come later to regret it and not really know how to pull back a little bit, offer less than we mean to in a way to keep a private sphere. And so I offer then a creative tension between the ideals of the digital preservationists, Stuart Schieber is among us and has been thinking a lot about that, who are looking at decades and centuries as to how to preserve our content, our data, our texts. I think we, in a way, owe ourselves to think through net architecture in a way that's meant to preserve our ability to innovate for decades and centuries, not just for a little while. And yet, Judith reminds us that it's not just digital preservation, it's digital retraction and digital deletion. How to actually maintain some level of control over the net so that we preserve our identities even as we preserve the net itself. Did I make it under 5?
You did. You hit all 3 themes. And people will still buy the book because you didn't give away the
book. Yes,
all right. So thank you to the 4 of you. Great set of provocations, dynamically tense, I think, is how you've left it. But I suspect others have comments on this. Hey, Doc, since you are a founder of One Web Day, would you like the job of going first?
Well, geez, where to begin? You know, I don't know. What I would visit is simply the. And this is in the spirit of One Web Day rather than of the sort of debate that you've set up here. But as a matter of appreciation of where we are now, which is actually the idea behind One Web Day, if it weren't for, I mean, of course we could say if it weren't for the web, none of us would be here, I suppose. But I certainly wouldn't be here. I might just be another close to retirement marketing guy who still did some writing on the side. When the web came along in the mid-90s, which is something I saw coming, and when I first heard about it in the early 90s, I looked at it as a kind of salvation for somebody whose writing did not fit any particular mold. I failed to sell my writing to pretty much every PC magazine that was out there. Even though everyone said, well, your writing is really good, but I couldn't sell it. Eventually, Linux Journal approached me. I knew nothing about Linux, but I wrote about everything that Linux touched, which was mostly connected on the web. And I've had, you know, a hell of a time just thinking out loud about things that the web touches, and especially the web itself. And I have to say, I go back and forth, I mean, getting over to the debate point and where we're going in the future, between the dystopian model of all the things that are going to go to hell and how the bad guys are going to be out to get us and so forth, and the idealistic, almost utopian model, which I think it is utopian, except we happen to live in utopia. So we've already gotten there, as far as I'm concerned. So how do we keep utopia? That's kind of a taller order than making one, I think, in some ways, because we sort of stumbled into it, and now we're thinking about what it is. What are the core values? What are the core architectural natures of this thing? What is it about us, speaking to Jonathan's point about generativity, that sustains this place? What is it that we each bring to it personally that make all of us more valuable, and all of us that we contribute more valuable? I'm even fascinated by what the fact of the web in our midst does to definitions of things like, of words like information, which for the longest time we treated as something static. Information is something that you put into a server or something. But in fact, this comes out of a conversation I had with Tim O'Reilly years ago about the problem both of us had with the term information, which is that we have this static idea about it, and yet it's derived from the verb to inform, which is derived from the verb to form, which is what we do when we hear each other. It's what we do when we learn from each other. We are all, in either Tim's words or mine, I forget whose it was, we are all authors of each other. We are all changing constantly. So to address Judith's point, how do you follow that? It isn't just an avatar walking through the world. It isn't just a history. It's what we do to and with each other that is profoundly human and yet very, very hard to describe or to nail down. So anyway, that's just sort of a general appreciation of where we are right now, which I feel very privileged and lucky to be part of. I keep looking at Andy because Andy's written a lot of cool stuff. And I see he's here, and I feel lucky that he's here.
When you were talking, I was thinking of Marshall McLuhan. At one point, I thought, after all, he was a big guy in the 70s, and a lot of people were talking about him. He was totally incoherent, but I was trying to think if I could apply anything of what he said to the web. And I didn't find anything that much new, but he talked about hot media and cool media. Hot media give you everything you need, so they envelop you, and you don't have to think. And cool media let you put something in between. So the internet is definitely a cool medium, because now you can post an answer to any news article, and you can fill in. You can also take things and remash them and mix them up. So we distance ourselves from information, from content. So we have more control now.
Information that's been introduced, and Jonathan, I think, threw out a provocation to Stuart Schieber, and we also have Terry Martin here, who has just recently announced his retirement after 27 years of being the Harvard Law School librarian, quite a run. Two leading preservationists in our midst, and I wonder if I might put either or both of you on the spot in response to Jonathan.
Well, so I mean, it's a little tricky because much of the very concrete work I've done on long-term preservation of I guess you could call it information. It's scholarly articles. Some of those contain information. Others don't, but we just preserve them all on the off chance that, you know, in the long run, we'll be able to figure out which is which.
I'll ask you later which is which.
To a certain extent, the methods that I've proposed granted, for the short to medium term have been a bit Luddite. So, for instance, because there are these problems with our utopian or dystopian, I'm not sure, depending on who you ask, present, because it's not clear what's going to happen in over the decades in terms of preserving all this digital material, there's a worry that we could be creating the modern equivalent of the Library of Alexandria by publishing all of our journals online. And so the alternative that I've proposed and in fact been helping to implement is this kind of may sound kind of backwards, but to use the one mechanism we know can preserve data, namely acid-free paper, to preserve all of these online journals. So it sounds a little silly, but that's the best method I know of for preserving scholarly articles is to print them out and put them in a library.
I remember those.
So on the one hand, there's this worry. I mean, it's a very strange situation. On the one hand, there's this worry that the web won't be around long enough to be an archival medium in the sense that librarians mean an archival medium. So we need to resort to these prior technologies. And on the other hand, there's Judith's worry that the information is going to be around so long and it's so difficult to get rid of this stuff that we're going to have this kind of dystopian situation where every accidental thing that you ever do that happens to get caught will be available for anyone to peruse and take advantage of in the long term. And I'm not sure how those two worries can both coexist, since they seem to be contradictory, but somehow they're both true.
So Judith wants to go next, but I think for Jonathan's purposes and others, we've been joined by our founder, Charlie Nesson, who's come to the back of the room, and none of this would have happened but for Charlie's inspiration with Dorothy Zinberg and others more than 10 years ago, to be sure. So welcome, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Jim, but I haven't tuned in enough on the conversation.
You're not on the spot yet. I just wanted Jonathan, who's out there, to know that you were back
Hello,
there.
Hello, Jonathan.
He can't, you see, he can't quite see you. Is
I see, it looks to be a turtleneck. That's all I can tell.
Very good.
Good guess, Jonathan.
All right, so you can throw it up then over to Terry Martin.
So this would be quick, but this is somewhat bringing together the themes of fashion and fair and information, because I'm also very interested in fashion, and I think there's a very strong relationship between fashion and information. And one of the things that fashion does is it's this constant demand. I look at things in terms of signals. You know, if you're trying to signal that I am cool, you have to, the thing that you are signaling, I'm cool, or I am a company like IBM that's in the forefront of everything, you still have to keep changing how you do it. So if you're a person dressing, the type of clothes you have to wear have to keep changing. If you're a company like IBM, 2 years ago you had to like social networks, and this year you have to like Second Life. So there's fashions in everything. But one of the things being at the forefront of fashion is about dealing with fear, because it involves taking risks. You know, for all of you computer programmers, you know that when you decide to use a new language, you know, the week it's released, you will spend an enormous amount of time learning a language, which is then either going to be obsolete or you're going to be the one debugging it. So that cutting edge of fashion always involves a tremendous amount of risk. As humans, I think we have an innate fear of change. But we're living in a society that changes at an unprecedented rate. And the net and the web are doing a huge amount to accelerate that. And so I think there's a very important relationship. And while fashion may seem frivolous, it is this external sign of willingness to change, of willingness to constantly adapt, that you're willing to give up something that was comfortable that you knew and just constantly reinvent how you do things, what you do, whether this is good or bad. Again, this is another one of these dystopic, utopic versions.
You seem insistent that we should be right up this
moment. Yeah, we should be voting whether these are good or bad. But I think one of the things about the net is the fantastic rate of change that it enforces on everybody. And I think what we are just at the beginning of understanding is what does it mean to live in a culture in which there is this level of constant change and constant learning. So that's the fashion relationship. And so fashion may be a signal of your willingness to adapt and why once we reach a certain age, we stop being so fashionable. And it's this external sign that maybe we're not adapting as quickly.
Terry Martin, have you led the Harvard Law School Library, the world's greatest collection of law books at this moment of change, and with lots of fashion swirling around you. Do you agree with Stuart and Jonathan? And then we'll go to Dorothy and then to
I think the future is clearly digital. I just want to say something about fashion, though. The best thing about fashion is it can't be copyrighted. Now, Terry Fisher will explain why that hasn't made Armani poverty-stricken, but he's managed to do okay. But, I mean, Stuart is correct in that we know how to preserve paper better than we know how to preserve digital stuff. I mean, so there's a lot of experiments with digital preservation. MIT has their big DSpace initiative, which means they go and they capture it, and they put it on a computer someplace, and if somebody wants it at some point in the future, they will figure out how to get it out of the computer and display it for you, but they'll do it then. Harvard has a different approach in that it defines a number of formats in which you can deposit digital objects. So we'll take a PDF because we know what a PDF is, and if there's something better than a PDF in the future, we can figure out how to convert current PDFs into something else. Neither one of those is probably going to be perfect. I know DSpace is going to hit some little stash of data that they won't in 20 years be able to figure out. And Harvard isn't going to be collecting some stuff because it doesn't fit one of their defined formats. So we'll lose stuff. But it's not really economically possible to convert all the digital information into some kind of printed form. And you'd miss a lot anyway. You'd have to take something that's three-dimensional and make it two-dimensional. So the world is going to be digital, and librarians are struggling with, how to do that. And so we're just knocking off little pieces of it a bit at a time. You've got the Stanford approach, which is basically to throw it out onto the world. Have their approach called locks. Lots of copies keep stuff safe. So they just find a dozen people willing to, on their own little server, back up some scholarly journal. In the hopes that this is you can understand why somebody who sits on an earthquake fault would want to run.
Jonathan, are you on an earthquake fault right now?
Digging a very large hole right outside my office. I'm not sure why, but it feels a little earthquakey around here.
Before we go to Dorothy, do you want to respond to any of these comments?
No, let's keep rolling.
Yeah, if I could, I'd like to add a personal note and a somewhat different tack. I had 10 years at Harvard Medical School in biochemistry, and then got very interested in sort of the social psychology and politics of science. And in the 60s was what was then known as the head section man for Eric Erickson at Harvard, who was then the big man on campus and a psychoanalyst of some distinction. And now I serve on a committee that is thinking through where would a mind like Erickson's be today. And one of the questions I had, Jonathan, this goes back to something you raised on how do we preserve our identities. And I was thinking of social psychological identities, because if you look back to the 60s, I think it was the beginning of when parents were no longer the only transmitter of values and the culture, that the peer culture began to take over. Now you've got the net, and the difference between where the parents are by and large and where younger people are. And what I've brought up at the Erickson Institute is how does one think about identity between a therapist and a patient or client when the therapist inhabits one world of thinking and the client, younger client, another? And does this make a difference? And even though the therapist, whom we assume will always be somewhat older than the patient, is hip about what's going on in the net, does the fact that the client has been brought up on this as reality and the first reference? I mean, I was just thinking today, why don't I remember to bring my laptop with me? I keep meaning to, but I simply never do. And everything I do on this is learned. It's not automatic. And so I guess what I would love to see this group, someone somewhere in this group, begin to think through is what's the impact on cognition? And
I think you have at least 4 or 5 people working on that problem across the table. So
yeah, because about 10 years ago, I began to notice that my students thought very differently from me. We may have gotten to the same answers, but we got there by a different route. And it's understanding that
you knew the answer and they Googled it.
Exactly. A very, very different kind of approach. And again, Jonathan, when you were speaking, I had a thought I had not had in many decades, which was when I was in young part of grammar school, I had a wonderful teacher, a woman. When we were learning about the Gettysburg Address, she said, "Words never go away. And Abraham Lincoln's words are still out there. And someday we're going to know how to get them back." And I feel, you know, that's where I am now, that people are working in a way of pulling out what we always thought had disappeared, but it's there. Thank you.
So,
Before you call on the professional sociologist, John?
Not quite yet, but anyway, you go ahead. I'm a psychologist from Stanford.
Well, it calls to mind Charlie's observation from the very beginning, you know, cyberspace is a rhetorical space. And it's a place where you fix a message, and you have to understand it as a message. And I think it's right for Dorothy to ask, what is the message or the set of messages that our kids get now that they plug in, like, to something like Club Penguin so early and learning about what's out there on the network? And I fear that the kind of cyber crypto libertarians among us don't really think that through too much. It's just, hey, it's our job just to keep the tumbleweeds going through the middle of the western town and everybody with a holster that has a good six shooter in it, and everything else will sort itself out. And of course, I don't think the quote unquote sort of family values people who are just terrified of any form of thinking that isn't mainstream really have figured this out either. But it calls to mind to me something Andrew Sullivan actually just pointed out in his blog. There was a video posted on YouTube of some very young woman who'd been asked to sing the Star Spangled Banner at like an NBA playoff game or something, and she forgot the words in the first verse. And I mean, you know, it's a pretty high stress situation. She's forgotten the words. People are sort of laughing, and kind of the way when a bunch of dishes fall at the dining hall, people sort of applaud a little bit. And then a coach of one of the teams comes over and stands next to her and starts the song again with her, singing along with her. And then the entire audience starts singing with her too. And by the end, it's like, you know, tears are streaming down everybody's face as we celebrate how great America is. But the thing that the reason I thought of this right now is because there's an example of a viral video that isn't the normal punchline of somebody screwed up, I'm so glad it wasn't me, check this out. Kind of has an element of social cruelty to it, and as Homer Simpson would say, it's funny because I don't know him. And trying to figure out how to structure the environment so the messages that bounce around aren't just the capability we have to laugh at each other in a cruel way, but to celebrate each other.
Good. So, Carrie and company, you'll no doubt have responses to this, but Terry Fisher had his have next to you. You want to go, or you could also see, and we'll come back to you.
I want to pursue, at least briefly, this idea of identity that has circulated in many of the comments thus far, and venture a hypothesis, see what people think.
We hear you, Jonathan.
Sounds like me.
So, compressing a lot of time, you might think of a feudal state of affairs as one in which work, home, and play are integrated. Do all in the same place and with more or less the same people. And you very rarely move in your life. And those conditions conduce to an extremely stable, integrated sense of and projection of self. Everybody knows you and knows you in all guises in your town. And among the features of modernity carried to its extreme in the United States is the fragmentation of each of those conditions. So work, home, and play are differentiated, and they come to be engaged in different places with different people, and moreover, people move homes, move jobs, move avocations radically in the course of their lives. And what this facilitates is a fragmentation on the one hand of community, no surprise there, but also a fragmentation of identity, in which you can be different people in different settings and different people at different moments over time. And a state of affairs that a postmodern theory celebrates, other people lament. So here's the hypothesis, is that in some ways the technology with which we are concerned is corroding the conditions of modernity and returning us to a feudal state of affairs, in that once again work, play, and home are coming together, in that people work from home and they merge their, like, how many people here use different emails for their personal stuff and their work stuff? Probably not many. Most of us have an email, a primary email address, and we integrate across them. And you work when you get up in the morning and you play in the middle of the day. It's sort of swirled together. And then the preservation information that Jonathan and Judith were emphasizing is corroding the capacity to remake yourself over time, remake yourself afresh over time. You are all continuously aware of your past, and other people are continuously aware of your past and maybe projected in the future. So, weirdly, those are the conditions of feudalism and stable identity, now on a global scale rather than a village scale. So are we going to abandon the fragmentation of self that was the condition of modernity? It's possible. But so here's the hypothesis. Despite the return of conditions that led to the stable self in, say, the 15th century, we can't go back on this front. And we're going to have to, we already are, accepting a degree of fragmentation in the new environment that is in some tension with its sociological and technological conditions. And maybe we want to go further and to facilitate it, like Jonathan's idea. I don't know whether it's still in the draft of the book, of the identity bankruptcy, when you decide to wipe the slate clean of your accumulated reputation and start over again, be one conceivable way of achieving this. Another form might come to pass in politics. So to go back to Gene's theory about where this is going to go for civic life, so we have accepted in most democracies, certainly in the United States, for about a century, historians sometimes refer to as the Victorian Compromise, in which we tolerate a whole lot of oddity in behavior as long as it's private. but what we insist upon is a well-scrubbed public face. And what blows up a politician's career is the revelation in public of what we have compelled to remain private, whether it's Bill Clinton's behavior or whatever. And that may not be possible soon, that our access to all the information over time of every person's life may compel us to accept fragmented, imperfect selves in the political arena, as we increasingly are obliged to do so in the private arena, and to abandon our puritanical insistence upon the well-scrubbed face in politics as well as in private life. Just some hypotheses.
Oliver would like to go, but would any of the others on the Trinitarian team or others?
I'm getting a look that I should probably say a word or two about a project that I'm working on under the Good Play project called Developing Minds in Digital Media. And we have private funding, and it's a two-year project looking at cognition through... And we're in the midst of writing a paper right now, and we're going to be doing some empirical research and addressing exactly these questions that you brought up. So,
good.
Yeah, very exciting stuff.
The only other thing I wanted to add is we're interested in a number of the tensions that have been raised here. Our focus is on the ethical issues that are coming up as young people spend time immersed and engaged in all of these digital spaces. And I guess the main thing we're puzzling with is how we can prepare young people for the complexity of the web in its current state, these promising utopian visions, as well as the really risky dystopian trends people have spoken to. I think there's a lot of intimidation about it from the perspective of educators and parents in terms of what's going on right now, much less what will happen in the future. So I would invite people's thoughts on that. That's our sense.
Before going to Oliver, for those who don't know, the Project Zero efforts in this area, the Good Play Project that Howard Gardner, Cherry, and others are doing, they have a wonderful white paper already on this topic, which addresses Terry's identity segments wonderfully over a few pages. Interesting conversation. Professor Goodenough.
Well, I have a question I'd pose to those who know rather more about all this than I do. But that is, one of the things that I would think might be happening in the next 10 years on the web is that it may be contributing to the rapid demise of a text-based intellectual society. I suspect there are people who have thought about this, but the library discussion was all around text, and at least among my children's age, text is going away. And one of the things that the web makes possible is the exchange of information and all kinds of things in ways that are no longer primarily text-based. And so, is it audio-visual-based? Well, but even that probably is going to be passé. There seems to be something else going on out there, and I'd love to hear about people's thoughts on that. And when my kids...
There's something else you have in mind.
Well, there's something else... something else is what happens when it's not text, it's not audio-visual, it's truly digital. It's embedded in a digital world in the way that the interaction with an iPod is. What is that interaction, and where is that information? Is it beyond text? Is it beyond classic audio visual?
We must preserve our mouse droppings on acid-free paper.
Oh, okay.
Oh dear.
All right, I just would love to hear thought on that from people who have been thinking.
Sure. We've got one hand up over here, and I'm going to pass you the mic so that definitely get picked up for posterity.
Up on that thought, but I think that when I was thinking about the topic of today, I saw two different trends. One is enriched experience kind of at the computer, how do you go from a text-based to audio-visual and things like that. And then on the other side is the ubiquitous computing, and that to me begins to pick up the whole identity issues and then, what's the next step from texting, because I think that gets around the fact that the net might be omnipresent in us, because we're talking about embeds of chips and government initiatives to be able to identify you anywhere at any time.
And, you know, where do you take that when they can find you? Well, not they can find you, that sounds paranoid. But, you know, when your information is available all the time to anyone and you're communicating in ways that go beyond simple texting, do you then, you know, have that break between people who are Luddites who decide to completely drop out of the system and the people who have basically rolled over for the benefits that are conferred by, say, Identity 2.0 or your ability to, you know, move through the system completely identified because you're a person who never would mind being tracked throughout? I'm not making any sense, so I'm going to stop here.
Would you mind taking the mic? That'd be great.
I was sort of wondering what sort of the flip side of it, what's the impact on identity when we, say, do such a wide range of activities using a fairly limited number of, say, interface widgets, for lack of a better term? So we, you know, use interface widgets to, like, do our food shopping or buy a book on Amazon or, you know, do consumerist activities, and we also use those same widgets to express love and express our deepest emotions. And that sort of, it's sort of the opposite of the fragmentation that's being discussed. It's more of a, you know, every kind of emotional activity becomes one kind of formal activity. And I guess that's just another thing and obviously 3D worlds and there are all kinds of new interfaces, but that put that into question, but there's still the mouse and the keyboard and the like five or six interface widgets that exist in HTML and kind of, you know, they've been made prettier over the years, but they haven't really changed fundamentally. And we live our whole lives through drop-down boxes, text scrolls, buttons, and radio boxes. And what, you know, I kind of wonder, those are going to change, certainly, but I wonder what the implications of that are, if anyone.
So ostensibly my brief talk was about virtual worlds, but I think as I'm listening to this conversation, another contrast between what isn't really between virtual and worlds or 3D technology and graphics or text, but rather I hear a lot about identity and individual identity and individual privacy, and what I think I was trying to also convey is the contrast between that and group identity and having groups come together. And so I come at the question of the identity issue from the perspective of you, how does that help us come together as groups? How do we find our common interests, and how do we, for political or civic organizing purposes, find the commonalities across our identities so that we can come together as groups of people? So to some extent, I'm interested in hearing discussion at the level of groups coming together, which is what's interesting to me about Facebook and all of these other social networking sites, as opposed to just simply looking at only individual privacy or individual identity or individual empowerment.
So I'll take a jump back to the information and movement from text to other digital forms of information. To say one of the components at the heart of lots of the excitement that I was trying to describe was the ability to mash up information that we find. And so far it's been easiest to do that with text, and so lots of the coolest things that we see are text analyses and combinations of text or even easier numerical data from multiple sites and multiple sources. So there are possibilities both cool and somewhat disturbing as that mashup ability is carried over into new streams of data. What happens when videos of us can be annotated to note where it is that we have been in both our online and offline travels, possibly without our permission or consent to those kinds of monitoring? What happens when our voice and our vital signs can be added into that picture? And what can we do if it's not granting ownership of that data and regulating it from that direction to reach toward sort of fair ways of dealing with data that has kind of shared ownership and shared interests in it.
Wendy, thank you. So to let people get on with their day, I think we might go for two more comments. Jonathan, do you want to have a second to last penultimate comment by way of bringing things together? And then I'm going to bring the microphone down to Charlie. Oh, and Terry. These are definitely taped. At day one, not quite. When did we start taping this? A few years. Yeah.
Where do we find day one?
The day one would be at the Media Berkman site, but I'm not sure where day one, what moment in time day one is, but it's in the last few years. Yeah. Jonathan, I'm sorry. Jonathan's in Stanford, I think. Right? All right, from Palo Alto, penultimate word from Jonathan. It looks Stanford.
The cars outside the window are driving on the right. So.
All right. You shoot, and then Charlie's up for the last word.
So I just want to say delighted to be included in this. Thank you, David Weinberger, for pulling it together, and just so much looking forward to the various special events. We'll be doing this, how do you say, 10 decanal year? Decadal year? Something like that. And on to Charlie.
My thought about the next 10 years is pretty much the same thought as I had.
So you got to give him a microphone.
Can you hear me, John?
When you shout like that, yes.
Maybe I'll come up to the table. Well, my thoughts about the next 10 years, as I thought about it, are pretty much the same as they were the last 10 years, and in some way they proved out over the last 10 years, and I expect them to prove out more. It's the essence of the environment is, as John puts it, a rhetorical space, a communication space, an open network, and it challenges at both the individual and the institutional level. At the individual level, I feel we're all in the posture of having to live in a more open environment and coming tuned into it, getting used to the idea that privacy has really changed, and maybe Scott was right in 1992 when he said it's dead. And at the same time, it's obviously not, but it sure is on the move and has been. And so I, for example, have felt comfortable having the SIG on my email state explicitly that my email is subject to be public. And if someone wants it and expects it to be private with me, let me know, rather than working the default the other way around. And I feel in some way that that's expressive of our life to a much greater extent. And individually, it challenges you to live a more integrated life. I was always told by Fred Friendly, who was my mentor, tell the truth, it's the easiest to remember. And the idea of having the truth be the same in all your lives and possibly exposed in all your lives is a personal challenge. In some way, life becomes easier if you can live it in many separate spaces at the very same time that managing those spaces get hard. And then at an institutional level, it has struck me from the beginning that what's happened is we've moved into an environment in which transaction costs of connection have dropped to a point where it's no longer a function of capital. This was a totally open environment. Nobody filled it to begin with. We didn't understand what the potential was. But you could understand that the potential lay in connection. And when we see something like Wikipedia, we see that there are new forms of organism that are possible, that aggregate huge amounts of collective energy. And they're inventions. These are actually conceptual inventions. And they aggregate power. I believe over the next 10 years that we will see increasing innovation in the ways in which we aggregate collective power through the net. And I'm optimistic about it because I've always felt that it's actually easier to aggregate goodwill than it is to aggregate evil. And so in some sense, in the grand battle of good and evil, I feel there's a certain divinity in the net. I feel we're on the right side. And So what I'm looking for myself in the next 10 years is, I'd say, a solid business plan for the open net, a way in which the people who and institutions who benefit from the open net come increasingly to see the open net as a source of benefit and participate in structures for supporting it and protecting it against the forces which would disaggregate it. And I'm very hopeful that that's the direction in which we're moving.
Charlie, awesome. What a great way to end. And thank you, everyone, for being here. Hope to see you next time.